Conversation with Kate Sanderson Waldron took place at her home in Beauville on July 8, 1976. The interviewer was Sam Schrager.
We're Southern Idaho and gotten all of our furniture, and it had just come. It wasn't even unpacked. And I felt terribly bad about it because I had some of Ray's mother's furniture, and it was antique, marble top tables and things like that. And I was so happy to have those things. And one of the most beautiful dressers that I have ever seen. It was just mammoth. And the mirror in it was as long as that post down to there. And had little drawers on each side of it, and it was just a real antique. It might have even been Ray's grandmother's, but I was just keen about that. And the forest fire just got everything we had.
Was that all in Slabtown, or all those things?
Well, I wasn't living in Slabtown. Yes, it was between where Mama's, where Byers lives now. Mm-hmm. And then you go right by Byers, isn't you? There's a road. If you follow that road out, you turn mm-hmm. when you get up a ways. Mm-hmm. And there's where we had bought this little shack, 2-3-room shack, it really was. And we had moved it. We bought it from a man by the name of Fry. And we had moved it down there into that place.
I see. You moved it from Slabtown. I see. Was that Sam Fry you bought it from?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we was gonna have our... We kind of wanted to be by ourselves. Get out of Slabtown. I didn't live in Slabtown. I did one time, but we wanted to get down near Mama, the home where Byers and John lived. We wanted to. And it was just about halfway between there and Slabtown. And forest fire got everything.
What, can you tell me what happened that day, the way you remember it?
Oh, land, yes. You know, that fire had worried me for days. It was such a black, black smoke. And my father had told me, don't worry. That fire is so far away it never could come over here. It'd have to come clear over that meadow. And he said, you haven't a thing in the world to worry about. But I worried anyway. I was afraid of it. So I got up that morning, and Dad reassured me again. It was so far away it couldn't possibly come over there. Well, I went over to the neighbor's. It was a neighbor, lived right across the road. And I said, aren't you afraid of that fire? Why, no, Miss, he said, Kate, that fire couldn't possibly come over here. So I went home, and Mama was ironing. And I was still worried about that fire. And within an hour's time, we were running for our lives. That fire, the wind come up and that fire come across that great meadow, those miles and miles just come a-flying. And the first thing I knew, a man came by in a, I don't know whether it was a, what he was driving. It was some kind of a car of affair, as I remember, or a pickup, I don't know what it was. And he grabbed both of my kids, and they were little. My little girl was about 3, and my little boy was about 5. And he picked up my sister's baby. She was only about 1.5 or 2 years old. And he said, now you people get out of here and get downtown. He said, because he said, that fire is here and it's dangerous. And I wouldn't leave until Mama'd leave. And, of course, Mama, Dad had told her, and she had some bonds that she had there in the house. And she didn't know where Dad had put those bonds, and she wasn't going to let those bonds burn up. And she just fooled around and fooled around. And I said, well, Mama, I said, we've got to get out of here. There was great balls of fire, oh, about that big around. And they just come through the air and light on a tree, and that tree was just aflame in a few minutes. And the awfulest roar and the awfulest wind you ever saw, it was just terrible, and that terrible, terrible fire. And Mama come out the door. My mother was a woman that weighed about 200. She was a heavy woman. She wasn't like I am. I was about the weight I am now, I guess. And she come down the steps, and I was just in front of her. I wouldn't go until she'd go. And yet I'd run ahead of her a little ways. And she said afterwards, she says, I don't know how you ever kept your feet. She said that wind was so terrible that she said, I couldn't hardly keep my feet. And how you ever kept your feet, she says, I don't know. And we got downtown to the depot.
Did you run all the way there?
Yes, just as hard as we could go, we ran. And the fire was breaking all around when we got down to the depot. The fire had come over the hills, and my brother stayed home, my brother John. And I don't know whether Dad did or not. I don't remember, but I know my brother John did. And my husband was out on the train. He was a fireman on one of the logging engines. And I could hear that engine. I knew every whistle on every shay that worked. I knew their signals and everything. And I could hear my husband blowing that whistle and calling for help. And you might know how that upset me. And I said, that's Ray, Mother, that's Ray. And I said, they're calling for help. And of course, I was terribly upset. And
that meant they must have been caught in the fire someplace, or
they were calling for help. They had come on the railroad as far as they could come, and there was great trees on the track, and they couldn't get by, and they were calling for help. I guess they got help, because I got down to the depot, and I was looking for my youngsters, and I saw my sister's baby there, and she'd been crying, and she was dirty. She'd gotten in the dirt, and I had rubbed it on her little face, and I didn't even know her. And finally, I said, my land, Leela, I said, that's your baby. That's your little girl, that dirty little girl there. And we were just horrified.
How had she gotten down there? The same man?
Yeah, she had run. She was down to the house and had warned us that the fire was coming over the meadow and came down there to bring the news to us.
The little girl had?
No, Mama. Or uh-huh. My sister, the mother of the uh-huh, little girl. Uh-huh. And I found my two kids in the depot. They were all huddled around there, you know, in the depot waiting for the flat cars. They had flat cars there, and people were climbing on the flat car because they expected Bovell to go. And my brother John, in the little house that he lives in, you know it's out there, uh-huh. That fire come right down to that corner where I told you you'd go by and turn, and the wind carried the fire right up that way. Now, I don't know whether you're a Christian or not, but my brother John is a wonderful Christian man. And that was his home, and he was just married, and it was a brand new home, and he had beautiful furniture in it. And he just prayed, kept praying, and asking God to protect his home. And that wind, that fire came right down to the corner of my father's land, and it turned and went that way, and that saved Bovell and the whole country. Now, some people would laugh at that, but that's just exactly what God did. He just turned that fire, and it took off up over the hill, and it saved Bovell. And then we were on the flat car going to Poplatz. And
were there a lot of, was
oh
was
yes,
it mobbed?
All the people in Bovell, all the people had climbed on that flat car because they didn't know what that fire do. It was breaking all over the hills out there. And I was on the flat car And I looked over the pile of clothes over there on the, and I said, you know, Mother, I said, that looks like I had a brand new dress, brand new peculiar shade of blue. And I said, you know, Mother, I said, that looks like my dress. And I said, that other thing looks like my winter coat. And Mama said, well, go over and see. I went over there, and it was my dress. I never have known where it came from. Never have known. I think somebody went by the house and saw that those clothes hanging there and just grabbed them, put them on a truck, and dumped them on the car and thought the people that had owned them. And when we came home after they said the fire had gone over the hill, and Bogle was safe, and we came home, I saw a stove sitting out in the meadow over there. You come down that hill to come into Bogle?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that meadow over there. And I said to my mother, I said, Mama, I had a brand new range, wood range. We had just bought it. And I said, that looks like my stove. And, oh, no, she said, that wouldn't be your stove way down here. Well, I said, it looks like my stove. And got out and went over there, and it was my range. I don't know how it ever got there. Somebody just grabbed it out and set it over there where no fire could get to it. And just took a chance. That's the way people did things. Oh, it was sure a funny experience. I've never forgotten. And I had nightmares over that fire. And my dad had the awfulest time with me. I slept out on the front porch. And I, for 2-3 days, I had a nightmare. And there'd be a tree that was still burning, you know. And it would, at night, the wind would burn it up, you know. And it would light up, and I would rouse up in my sleep, and I'd see that, and I'd scream bloody murder. My dad slept upstairs. He'd come downstairs. What's the matter? I said, everything's on fire again. I said, look at that tree. And Dad would say, Kate, he said, that's just one tree, and it can't do a bit of harm. Oh, it was an awful experience. I was a wreck for weeks after that.
Oh.
Because we had lost everything we had, and we had just sent to southern Idaho and shipped our furniture clear up here. And I had been up here all winter long and all summer, and we'd just gotten along the best way we could, you know, and then we sent for our furniture. And we bought that little house. Oh, dear.
So the point where the fire turned away from Beauville was right where it turned away from Johnny's house.
Uh-huh.
And that was
just right up at the turn of the road. It would have swept everything and come right down to Beauville if it hadn't turned. It would have cleaned this place out completely. Because that wind and those great balls of fire, they'd just come sailing through the air, and they'd light in a tree or they'd light on a building. And Dad and John fought them. Those balls of fire were falling when Mother and I left. But Dad and my brother John would put them out, would fight them. They stayed there. They didn't leave at all. And Ray would have been there if he hadn't have been out there on the railroad.
How long did it take before you found out that Ray was all right?
Oh, I don't remember, but it wasn't very long. They knew at that time, you know. They made special efforts to let the people know.
Did you go all the way into Potlatch?
Oh, yeah. We went clear to Potlatch. Stayed there all night. I don't remember whether we stayed all the next day or not. It's been so long ago.
So it upset you for weeks.
Oh,
it doesn't surprise
yes.
me.
I was a wreck for days. And I was so discouraged because we had lost everything we had and the house. And, of course, I had lovely bedding. And to just lose everything, I was just... And I was young. I was only 21, I guess.
How long had you been married at that time?
Oh, I'd been married 3-4 years. I had the 2 children. My little girl was 3 years old, my baby, and my little boy was about 5. I'd been married about, I think if I remember right, I'd been married about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Between 6 and 7 years. And
What did you do then to start rebuilding again?
Well, we spent the winter with Mama. The house, see, Mama's house is where Byers lives. That's the old home place. It don't look like it did then. It's terribly run down now. And I lived with Mama all that winter. We had to. We didn't have no place, no home or anything to keep house with or anything else. And Ray was just a working man. And we lived with Mama that winter. And then the next spring, we lived with Mama, I think, that next summer, too. And then we moved downtown here. That ended our building a home out there. Well, we did start us a log cabin out there once, 2 years later. I wanted to log cabin, and we decided we'd build us a log cabin out on the home place. But we gave that up, too.
It probably took you really years to recover what you lost in that fire.
Oh, yes. I never did recover some things. All my wedding gifts and my silverware, I recovered a lot of it and kept it as a souvenir because it was so hot that it had just melted, you know. I was thinking I might have a piece of that. I might show it to you. I don't know.
So you went back home, and the house was burnt down, but there was a lot of remains of... the house itself did burn down then?
Oh, yes, everything burned down, but there were some things. Now, like that silverware, it was packed in a tub, a zinc tub, and there was enough over it so that it was just the heat melted it. I think I have a couple of spoons in the house here. I'll get them.
Okay.
I have them as souvenirs. Some of it I've got has got great big gobs of silver that melted and just stuck on up here. But it ruined it. It was brand new stuff. It was, I never had used it.
It's beautiful silver, too.
Yeah, it was Roger silver. And I had a lot of extra pieces, berry spoons and things like that that was with it. And I don't know where I put those. I think they're in an old trunk that I have.
Did many other people lose everything in that fire, Mrs. Waldron?
Oh, all the people in Slaptown did. Of course, now some of those women buried their fruit. They had their fruit. It was in August, you know, and they'd had their canned fruit. And at Slaptown, they buried there, and they saved their fruit, canned fruit. Of course, then canned fruit was really harder to get up here a lot than it is now because we didn't have no cars, and we just had to buy it down here at the store and can it, you know. And it was really expensive.
But they didn't have warning either to bury their silver and their valuables.
They did bury people in town here. Lots of people, the old timers. I don't think there's any of them left. There, Nell Smith might be one of them that was here then.
I spoke to her about it. She was here at that time.
Yeah. And you know, I went upstairs and packed a suitcase, and I thought of that when I thought of Nell. Because Nell did the same identical thing with some of her clothes. She just made a mess out of everything. So did I. And I grabbed a suitcase and I guess anything I'd see. And I had my sister's graduating underskirt. Mom had made it with strips of insertion and little tucks, you know. And it was a beautiful lace skirt. I had that in my suitcase, and I had I had an evening slipper. I had one of her slippers, an evening, just one. Didn't have the pair. I had one. I had the office mess in that suitcase. You just wouldn't think anybody that was. Well, I wasn't sane. You know, I was just insane at the things. Anything I could see, I grabbed and shoved into that suitcase, and I didn't have anything that amounted to anything.
Oh, I can understand it, to have everything all at once, everything
and
you going.
Just, you're in such a hurry to get it out, and you want to try to get things that that you prize, you know. Mama didn't prize nothing but those bonds. That's what she was after, what held her up.
Did it hold her up for long?
No. She realized that she realized she'd have to let them burn, and we started out for town, and the fire was breaking in all around. And that wind was just, that wind, why, that wind carried you. You didn't have to run. Just take a step, you know, the wind was so bad.
Really?
And, but the bombs didn't burn because the house didn't burn. And, but it was a sure funny trip and a terrible thing. And I'm deathly afraid, that's the only thing I'm afraid of here. We don't, the snow and things like that don't bother me a bit, but I am deathly afraid of forest fires. I'm just scared to death of them. A pile of smoke coming up unexpectedly, it just, even as long as that's been, it just sends chills down my back, because I'm so afraid of them. But thank goodness we don't have any right around here, and haven't had. Right. But you could never, never, never. It could be clear over there on those mountains, and I'd want to leave and get out, because you can't tell. My father's been up here, an old man that had worked up here for years and years and years, and that neighbor was an elderly man, and why that fire and many more come across that meadow than it could fly. It was, I think it was 7-8 miles away. I don't know how far it was across that meadow. You haven't a thing in the world to fear. And within a half hour, an hour anyway, we were running for our lives that very morning. And Dad had warned me every morning, because that fire had been there, going there for days. Mm. And the smoke was so terrible, and the air was so heavy, and it just worried me to death. But it, nobody thought. None of the people, none of the old people that knew about the fire that worked in this country thought that fire would ever do any damage. They had no idea of it. And that's why people weren't prepared. But there were people here in Beauville, a lot of them, that had buried their fine china and their silverware. They just didn't know. They were like I was. They just didn't know. And I didn't think about doing anything like that. That wasn't what was bothering me. I wanted to get out with my kids. Get away.
I suppose you've heard the story that that T.P. Jones had taken the attitude to let it burn.
Yes.
Let that fire burn.
Yes. I don't know whether my brother Byers told you or not, but years and years later, he was working on the CC, and he had a crew of men out here in the mountains somewhere. And he had a general that was working there. He was one of the head men. He might have had a crew of men, boys himself. And he come tearing into camp one night, and he says, "What are we going to do?" He says, "The whole country here is on fire." And Fire says, "Well, where?" He says, "Where's the fire?" And he says, "Well, come up here and see." Byers went up the road a little ways in the woods, looked around, and he says, "Well, where's the fire?" And he says, "Well, can't you see it?" And, well, Byers says, "That's the sunset." He says, didn't you ever see a western sunset before?" He says, "I never saw a sunset like that in my life." He said, "You're wrong." Well, Byers had laughed. He says, "I am not wrong." He said, "That's why," he says, "we have those sunsets all the time." The poor old general, he felt so silly, but he lived back there in New York where they can't see anything but the sky, you know. And do well, I guess, to see that. Because he had boys that had never, never, never been able to sit and look like we do now at the heavens like that. They were raised right there in New York, you know. And they never could see anything.
Were you here when they had that fire the year before?
Yes.
The one that had burned town?
Yes. I was living out at Slabtown at that time when the Bovell burned out.
Yes.
Yes, I was living out there then. I was just a little ways from the shop, you know. And Ray worked. When we first come up here, that's where we lived, because Ray was a fireman, and the trains all come into that shop there. And my dad was foreman there, and he had about 700 men under him. And they had a big payroll. They thought when Bovell first started, you know, that it was going to be a marvelous town. We had a fine hospital. We had bank. We had two fine dry goods stores and two fine grocery stores. And there was taverns and rooming houses and a beautiful drugstore. And we had a doctor and two, three nurses in the hospital. It was a well-run hospital. And they thought that Bovell was just going to be quite a village, quite a town. And because Elk River's so far away, and this was the location that they thought was, but...
Did it boom? Was it a
really
good town
then? Oh, yes, it boomed. It boomed for a number of years. It boomed. And then they commenced gypoing. That's what played havoc with everything. It's when they commenced gypoing. It just went down and down and down. I don't think we even have a grocery store now. I guess there's a tavern that carries bread and a little milk.
Why did the gypoing do that?
Well, it did away with the railroad trains, and it was cheaper for the potlatch to let and the trucks and the cars came in, and give the men a better chance to make big money, and it was cheaper for the potlatch than for them to keep up their roads and their railroad tracks and their engines. I think they had four or five. I used to know exactly how many chaise and engines they had. I see there was the 123 and several others. I think they had about five.
But the more they went to gypoing, the more they got rid of their chaise,
yes,
and all that?
Uh-huh. The potlatch moved, sold the lumber, sold the gypoing logs to the men, and they've been doing that ever since. And it's proved out very, very good, because those truckers, they make good big money.
But it hasn't done much for Bovell.
But it added nothing to the city, to our village. It added nothing to it. The drugstore went out, and the bank went out, and the hospital went out, and the big stores went out, and they were beautiful stores, two beautiful dry goods stores. They just carried, you know, everything. And the drugstore, that woman, she just carried everything, the finest of china, gifts, you know, and besides her drugs. And the hospital, they had two, three nurses. And, of course, that took care of the men that were hurt, you know. What sick people were here.
Were there many many social activities going on when the town was booming?
Land, yes. People came here to the dances that they'd have, and the smorgasbord dinners that they'd have. We have a beautiful recreation room here now. Have you ever seen it?
I don't think
it's downtown. Over by where the depot is. You ought to go in there. It's a beautiful, and there's pictures on the wall that you might be interested in seeing. Nell Smith's husband, you know, worked 52 years for the potlatch all his life till he retired. And there's a good picture of him there. And
But there were a lot of get-togethers
yes, in this church, and a Catholic church. The old Catholic church used to be right up beyond that house, but it burned down. It's a little church now, down as you come down the hill. Mm-hmm. It's a little church, mm-hmm. You see. Pretty little church. And we just had high times. Smorgasbord, people from all over the country would come to our smorgasbord. And
who would put them on?
Oh, the Ladies' Aid. The Ladies' Aid would put them on. And it wasn't dead at all. And the dances, people came from as far as Garfield to the dances. And they had a moving picture house. Good shows. We had good shows. That's the old picture house down there, right straight down the street, that old great big old, I don't know why they don't tear it down now.
The old building there that says the museum on it now?
Uh-huh. That old great big old building right straight down the street there is the old opera house.
Did they dance in that opera house?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They danced upstairs. They had a big, nice dance floor. Yes. I took several prizes. Step, two-step, and waltz. And schottische.
Uh-huh. With prizes?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Beautiful prizes.
Do you remember the Beauvilles?
Yes, I remember the Bowler, a nice family. We came up here before ever I was married on the first train that ever came to Bowler. It was Byers and John were on that train too. And there wasn't anything here in Bowler but that old hotel down there where Mrs. Wanicky lives. And there wasn't any other buildings here at that time. That little old log cabin was there. And it was in that yard where we sat and ate our lunch that we had with us, a group of us young people. My dad worked for TP. He was a great friend of TP's, and he worked for TP. And, of course, we lived in Palouse. We were educated in Palouse, and we never came up here to live until, years later, because I was through school and married, and so was my sister. John wasn't married, but he was up here working with Dad. And, of course, he's the oldest one in the family. And Byers wasn't married then either. In fact, he was only in about the eighth grade when we moved up here. Mm-hmm. And my baby was 6 months old, my daughter, when we came up here. And I thought it was the jumping off place in the map. I didn't like it at all. I'd been living in southern Idaho where that it was sunshine. But Mama and Dad were here, and John was here, and Byers. And finally, my sister and her husband came. And they were living in Kennewick. And he was head carpenter here until he retired. All their married life.
Why had you moved down to southern Idaho?
Well, I was married in Palouse, and Ray's father was a real estate man down there in southern Idaho, and we went down there to live near his dad, and we were there for 4 years, I guess, or five, and Ray's father had land there. He gave each one of his sons 40 acres. And it's beautiful country down there, down close to Boise, you know. And that's where both of my children were born, was down there in southern Idaho. And we had 40 acres of land down there. And they were drilling for oil, and they had rocks that and the soil was for oil. And when we moved up here, why, we just decided that we wouldn't sell that land, that we wouldn't just keep it, because they sometime might find oil on it. Well, I kept it. My husband died, and I kept it until about 8 years ago. The taxes weren't too much on us, and I sold it. And I hadn't sold it. Well, really, I hadn't hardly finished the deal until they went to drilling for oil again.
Did they find any?
No.
I didn't think so.
But he didn't know that at that time. And my brother Byer said to me, he said, "That's just the Sanderson luck." He said, "You held that land for all these years, paid the taxes, and now," he says, "they're going to find oil on it." He said, "That's your Sanderson luck." But they didn't. I followed it very closely in the paper. I couldn't help but laugh. I said, "Oh," I said, "I don't know if they'll find oil or not." "Ah, they're very apt to," he said. "Now, baby," he says, "that's been a long time." And I don't know whether I was glad or sorry that they didn't find oil. I guess I was glad.
Yeah, I would have been.
I think I was, too, because I would have felt terrible if I'd have held that land all those years and kept the taxes up on it. It wasn't very much tax, but still it was taxes. And then sell it and have them find oil right after I mm-hmm. sold it.
Well, when you moved back up here and you were, you know, with the kids and were first back, or, well, first around, living around here, did you spend most of your time with the family, or did you spend much time in community type?
Oh, I had my nose into everything. We had a pinochle club, and we had a bridge club, and I was in church work, and I used to live in the house right over there, that big house over there.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't look like that. It had a great big beautiful porch on it at the time I moved there, and a cement fence all around it. And cement walks. It was a nice place. And I lived in the parsonage once, too.
Hmm.
And I moved from the parsonage over to that house. And, you know, now this is kind of funny. Because rent, you know how rent, high rent is. Well, I was paying $12 a month rent for the parsonage. And when I rented that house, I paid $25 a month for that house. And my brother just had a fit. $25 for rent? That's ridiculous. And I said, "Well," I said, "I wanted this house." And I said, "I'm willing to pay $25 or $40. I said, I'm sick and tired of living over there in that shack. And I said, "I'm not going to live there anymore." And my brother just thought it was terrible, because his wife, you know, when I had a better house, she wanted a better house. And that was what was driving him. But I laugh at that now, because, my, that was horrible rent. Mm-hmm. And now they rent these little tiny old shacks around here for $50, $60. Mm-hmm. And this little greenhouse over here rents for $120 a month. And that little trailer down there, the second trailer, is renting, and the woman that owns it is living in Lewiston. She rents it for $155 a month, her trailer. And rent is just sky high here. It's just ridiculous, I think.
Well, you know, I was asking about what you were doing then. I was thinking in general, did most of the women didn't work here then, did they?
No.
I mean,
no,
the husbands worked in the woods, and they
uh-huh.
they were mostly were homemakers.
I can tell you something very interesting. When Mr. Noggle was head man here, I don't remember just what year he took over here, but it was after TP. They never had anything but men flunkies. And I had a, and my boy was 14 and my little girl was, she was 22 months younger than he. And I went and asked Mama if I, and I, this woman and I, and I said to her, I said, let's get us a job. Our husbands were working out in the woods, gone, not home, only on the weekend maybe, or maybe they didn't get home on the weekend. And if they were way off in the Elk River country, you know, and it was so far away, why, they probably would work 16 hours a day. And I said, let's get us a job. And she says, well, what kind of a job? And I said, I want some new drapes. And I said, let's go out and work this summer. Let's go up and see Noggle, head man. See if he'll hire us as flunkies. Oh, she says, Kate, do you think we could flunky? I said, sure, we could flunky. I said, I know how. I said, I've been out to the camps and eaten there and watched them. I said, I know. I can wait on men at the table. And I said, I can peel vegetables. And so we went up to Mr. Noggle and asked him. And he just looked at us and laughed. And he said, we've never hired women flunkies. No, and I said, that's just why we think that you ought to try. I said, it'd be kind of nice to have women flunkies. Yes, he said, it would be. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'll give you women a job. And if you make good, he said, we'll hire women flunkies. And if you don't make good, he says, we'll never hire any. So we went out, and I said, well, I'd have to take my 14-year-old son with me because I said, I won't leave him in town with my mother, his grandmother. I said, I can leave my little girl with my grandmother, but I said, I want my boy with me. I said, I want to take care of him, watch over him. So he said, well, all right. He said, take your boy with you. So I had my son with me, and they never charged me a cent of board for him. And we made good. Well, I worked all summer until school started. I had to quit when school started. The other lady didn't have any children. And we moved to Spokane then. And, my husband was working for the Cedar Yard plant, and they moved to Spokane and offered him a good job and good money. So we moved to Spokane. And but the other girl, the other woman, she worked for years and years, and when I went to Mr. Noggle, told him I had to leave, I said, we're going to move to Spokane and put the kids in school up there where we could give them music and a few things that we couldn't give them here. And, well, he says, Miss Waldron, you girls have made wonderful, wonderful flunkies, and he said, we're going to have women flunkies now. And he said, if you ever want another job, just come and ask me, and I'll sure give it to you. And they have women flunkies right up, even now.
Well, you, sounds like you had quite a bit of weight on your shoulders. If you didn't make good, you'd never hire women.
No, that's what he said. He said, I knew we'd make good. And there was one old lumberjack. I'll never forget that. My dad, he knew my dad, of course, well. And he called me by my maiden name. And I had my washing out on the line. Both of us did. And we had dresses and aprons, and I had boys' shirts, all our clothes, you know. And this old lumberjack came in the house, in the shack, in the cookhouse. We had a lovely little cook, Shorty, we called him. He was clean as
Shorty Justice?
Yes.
I've spoke to him in Spokane.
Yeah, well, Shorty, he knows me well. And he was the cook, and he was clean, and he was the best cook. And he was just swell. And I, he was a nice little fella. We just thought the world of him. And he said, I was in the cookhouse, and this old lumberjack come in, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, and then he turned to Justice. And he said, Sanderson, he called me by my maiden name. He said, I've been a lumberjack for 40 years. And he said, I never saw washing on the line like that. Well, you know how the lumberjacks wash. They wash their clothes, and then they don't use any clothespins. They just throw them over the line. And you know how they'd look. And there our beautiful washing was, our aprons and white aprons and everything, you know, fluttering in the wind, you know, and he just stood there and looked. He says, well, I've been a lumberjack, Sanderson, for 40 years. And he said, I never saw a washing like that in a lumber camp before. And after he left, when I came home, we'd come downtown whenever we wanted to, you know. I asked my dad, and Dad laughed, and he said, why? He told me who it was. I said, well, I wondered how he knew me and called me by my maiden name. And the old dad says, he's known you since you were that high. But it was a nice experience. We enjoyed it very, very much. And the work wasn't a bit hard. Of course, we had to get up early. And the men, it only took them about a half hour to eat. They didn't allow them to visit very much at the table. They were to eat and get out of there. That was the rule.
They weren't supposed to talk? Was that part of it?
Well, they could talk, but they had to be out of there. They were not allowed to sit there and visit like we do at a table, you know, mm-hmm. take their time. They were supposed to eat. They did talk, that's true. And the first morning we went there, that's funny. The first morning we went there, those men came in there and their hair standing up all over their head. And some of them was washed and some of them weren't. They were the awfulest looking mess you ever saw in your life. And the next morning they came in, their hair was all combed and their faces were washed and they were slick as buttons. And it made all the difference in the world. It just made all the difference in the world among those men. And Mr. Knocko said that it was wonderful to have the women in the camp. Their influence over the men alone, that much, was just wonderful. And they were just as nice as they could be. That's what my dad had always told me about a lumberjack, because Ray was gone so much of the time. And I had my two little kids, and I was afraid. I was afraid at night. And Dad says, you don't need to be afraid of a lumberjack. He said, a lumberjack, if he'd come to your door and see you and those two little kids, he said, they have all the respect in the world. They wouldn't harm a hair on your head. But I was still afraid.
Mm-hmm. So,
and it made a big, big difference in the man.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. That really is.
And I got pictures that I wish I knew just where they were. I don't. Well, I do, I guess. Still, I'm not sure. And I'm pretty near blind, you know. I can't. But I've got pictures. We had all kinds of pictures taken I was driving those great, big, beautiful horses, you know. We'd go out, and the girl and I, or the woman that worked with me, and those teams that come by, they'd stop to come and get a bite at the cookhouse or something, you know. Why, the cook always took care of them. We never did. We only were in the dining room at dinner time, and then after dinner we cleaned up the dishes, and they had a dishwasher. We just took the dishes out and reset the tables and swept the floors, and that was our work. And then in the morning help peel the vegetables, and we were through by 9 o'clock. By 9 o'clock, the breakfast was over and the table set for dinner and the house all cleaned up, and we were out to our own cabin. We had a nice little cabin there. Cabins are nice. The potlatch built nice heavy cabins. And
when did you have to go back to work again?
At 11. Uh-huh. We'd go back at 11. We'd buy. 9 o'clock, we had all the vegetables peeled for that day that we'd have to peel, potatoes and vegetables of any kind, you know. And then we were free until 11 o'clock. Then we'd come in and put the butter on the table and get the whatever was necessary, if the jellies or jams or things like that. And then they'd serve dinner, see at 12. From 12 to 1, and then by 2 o'clock, while we were all through again, after dinner, and the table was set. We were free then until 4 o'clock. So it was a snap of a job and good money, you know. For those days, it wouldn't be anything for now. But they still have flunkies. My neighbor up there, Mrs. Thomas, flunkies every summer with her husband. She goes out, he works out in the woods. And they have a beautiful home, that big white home up there.
How much were you making then? Do you remember what they were paying you?
Oh, I think after everything was taken out of it, I think we had $90 or $100 clear.
Months.
But that was good money in those days, mm-hmm. You know. That was good money.
What time did you have to get up in the morning?
Oh, we got up about 4:30. We got up in time to clean ourselves up, to wash and comb our hair, and to go into the cookhouse to fix the coffee pots and things like that, you know. But it was nice work. And Shorty was so nice to work with. He was a lovely man, just so nice and clean. You never spleened against anything he'd cook, because he just was so nice and clean and a good cook. He was a lovely cook. But I sure did enjoy it. And my friend, Mrs. Preall, my land, she worked for years and years after I quit, because she didn't have any children, but we moved to Spokane and lived up there for several years.
And then came back down? Again.
And then we moved to Moscow.
Oh.
We moved to Moscow. And then the Depression hit. And we didn't come back up here until years later, about 20 years later, I guess. Because I worked in Moscow all the time.
Doing what?
I was clerking in the store, and I was head lady.
For which store?
Well, it was a Ben Franklin store then. And I could have worked at David's. They tried their best. I did work for David's. They tried their best to get me there. Land, I used to get so disgusted. I couldn't go to a sale to buy something for myself, but what they'd want to put me to work. And then I could have gone into Creighton's, too. Creighton's wanted me one time, too. And but my boss raised my wages. And he wouldn't let me go, so I stayed with him and worked for years. Well, then we came back up here, and we bought this place. And we were only here 2 years when my husband's health broke. He got up one morning to go to work. He was working in the shop then. And he just coughed and coughed and coughed, and I said, Ray, I said, you've got a terrible cough. I said, you can't go to work. I said, we'd better go over to Moscow to the doctor and get something for that cough. And he said, well, all right. And that was the end. He had heart trouble. And the doctor, Lohr, was then doctor. And he told me, he said, your husband is ill, desperately ill. And there isn't a thing we can do for him. He didn't tell Ray that, but he told me. And I was just, you might know how I felt. I just couldn't believe it. And that was the end. He never could work anymore. And we'd only been here 2 years. Just got started on fixing our house. We'd been working on the inside all the time. But we had great plans and dreams. That's what I tell my grandchildren now.
What you were saying to him makes me think of is this division, you say, between the people that drink beer and the people that, that go to church. Was this a division in the town in the early days, too? Was it the same kind of...
Yes, to a certain extent. It's always been the two classes. And there were... It wasn't so bad as it is now. it wasn't so bad as it is now, because it was a bigger place and there were other things, you know, to interest. There is nothing here for the young people, really, but to go down there to the taverns and the young, that they're not interested in the church. And I don't know whether they go out of town for their parties and things. I really don't know very much about that.
But in the early days, there would still be that...
That division. There was that division.
Mm-hmm. Were the church-going people really opposed to the drinking that was going on during Prohibition?
Yeah.
Because there sure was a lot of it, I know.
Yeah. Yes. They had one minister over here, and he wasn't worth powder to blow him up. And he said to my brother John, that we had a fire place out in the yard, standing around there, and he accused my brother John of being a bootlegger, and he said, "I know that you can give me some liquor now." He said, "I know you can." Well, John says, "You don't know no such a thing." Because my brother John was just horrified, because my brother John's a fine Christian man. I've never heard a slang phrase ever pass his lips in my life, not even darn. And he's never said an unkind word to me in his life. We have never quarreled. And I'm 86, and he's 93.
A bit older, yeah.
And he's just a good man.
How long has he been a Christian? When did he...
Oh, I've been
you
a Christian
said, No, he, you said he...
Oh, about 81 years.
He was just a boy.
Yeah, he was only about 11 or 12 years old. And my mother was to a big convention, a big camp meeting affair. And I don't even remember it. And my brother John was on crutches. He'd broken his ankle. And he was healed. A couple of ministers that were preaching there came along, and they said, "You know, John remembers this." They said to each other, they said, "You know, that doesn't look well, to see a little boy around in crutches like that." And they talked with John and prayed for him, and he was healed instantly. And that impressed him, of course, greatly. And he was converted, and he's been a Christian all his life. And then my mother was a very devout Christian woman. We were raised in a Christian home. And then John is the oldest one in the family, and he's always been such a nice Christian before us. It's impressed the family, you know. And I wasn't I've been a Christian too for 40 years anyway, and my brother Byers is a Christian. He goes to church every Sunday and is a Christian, very devout.
But before you were a Christian, what made the difference to you? I mean, when you say, weren't you, you were raised in a Christian home, doesn't that make you a Christian?
Well, no. I had gone to church and Sunday school, and I knew what was right and what was wrong, but I had never consecrated myself and had repented of my sins, whatever they were, and asked the Lord to forgive me and taken my stand and been baptized that I was going to be a Christian. I had never done that. When my kids were about, my little girl, I think, it was after the forest fire. I think she, no, was that? It was before the forest fire. Why, I was living up there at Slabtown, and there was about 14 little kids there. They had a school out there. There were so many children, they had a school out of Slabtown. And I couldn't come downtown here. We didn't have cars with two little children. I did come on the train when I shopped. The train run, but it didn't run on Sundays. And I had no way of getting down here, and I wanted my children in Sunday school. So I started a Sunday school myself. I financed it, and And I had little Catholic children, too. There was Catholic families there, and they had, one woman had 5, 6, 7 youngsters, and the other had children. And I had, 14, 15 little youngsters, and I had it in my home. And I started the Sunday school for my own little children.
What did you do? What was the course of the Sunday school? How did you conduct it?
I had little Bible stories, and I had little song books with little religious songs in them that I taught the children. And I had, we didn't have Crayolas in those days, so that they could color like they do now. We had little sewing cards, and I'd buy pretty cards for them. And then I would read and talk to them of the Bible stories, you know, and kids like to children love stories. And I would read, and we would sing, and then we'd have prayer. I'd talk to them, and I just taught them. That's the way I taught them. And I have a woman that visits me nearly every summer now. She was one of those kids. And she lives in Spokane. But she always comes and sees me, and we talk about our little Sunday school that we had. And I have several women living in town here that I taught Sunday school. I taught Sunday school a lot over here. And she must be 65, 66 years old. And she takes keen delight in telling every new minister to come here. Miss Walden was my Sunday school teacher. I said, yeah, that's why she's good today.
Well, just one thing that I'm curious about is what made you then decide to become a Christian? Well, how did that happen?
I always wanted to be a Christian, but I was too much of a butterfly when I was young.
Even when you were teaching Sunday school, you don't feel that then you were yet a Christian?
Yes, I wanted to be a real Christian. And I knew from the teaching that I had had in my Sunday school years, I knew that what I had to do, and I just decided that I'd rather. And then my brother was an awful influence in the home for all of us, because he's the oldest kid in the family. And mother was a devout Christian. And we were always taught right, you know. And it was things like that that influenced. I believe definitely if you raise a child and take them to Sunday school and teach them, I believe that really consecrated my life to Christ. I don't think I had grasped really what it means. But I wanted my children. It was my children that I was thinking of. See, and those other little children, they needed a Sunday school. And I think it was the Spirit of God working with me, because God knows everything. He could see the future. He could see, you know. And I think that it affected me as much as it did the children, but I wasn't conscious of it, see, because it was a number of years later
that I
really was converted and baptized.
Is that what made the difference, to be baptized?
Yes, that was the greatest experience I ever had. When I went down into that water, I felt just like I was being buried with Christ. That's what it represents to the world, you know, that you're buried. And when I came up out of that water, I was a new creature. I never had any desire for the world after that. And that was the most wonderful experience I ever had. And my father was converted by seeing me baptized. They said, people told me he was converted the next night, and people told me that he sat on that bank and the tears just rolled down his face. They said they felt so sorry for him. They didn't want to baptize me, the ministers didn't, because I was the only one they'd had their baptism service, and they just didn't really want to baptize me. And I said, well, I said, I must be baptized. I said, I'm not leaving this campground, I said, until I'm baptized. And I said, I want to be baptized. I said, I just want to be. And so they did, and I was the only one. They had that held the whole service, and I was, and it was me going down into that water. But my dad just couldn't take it. They told me.
Where was this camp meeting at?
Well, it was down towards Colfax. It's gone now. That campground is entirely gone. But it was down towards Colfax.
How long would that kind of thing go? Would it go on? Was it a series of? Would it go on for like a week? And
oh yes, uh-huh. It's about 10 days. It used to be about 10 days or 2 weeks, you know. And we'd go right down there and camp. And I finally, years later, I had a cabin built, but they sold that campground, and now they. I guess they meet mostly up at Loon Lake. They don't have any regular campground anymore.
Well, did it dawn on you all of a sudden when you were there that you wanted to be baptized?
Oh, yes. I wanted everything. Everything that the Bible tells you to do, I wanted to do.
Did you know that it was that it would have the effect on you that it had before you went in the water?
No, I didn't have any idea. But the minute I stepped into that water, of course I was saying to myself that, Lord Jesus, I'm going to be buried, and I don't know what I said, I don't remember, but I think I was breathing a prayer, because I was scared to death to be baptized. I didn't like the idea of going down under that water. I wasn't sprinkled. I don't call that baptism. I was baptized. I went waded down into the water, clear up to here. And then I held my nose. I was just scared to death. And but I was going to do it. And I did it. And I was glad I did it. I felt like a different person when I came up. It was the most wonderful experience I have ever had. And I tell my friends, and when I'm teaching, I tell my classes. Of course, I don't teach anymore because my eyes and my hearing, too, isn't too good. And I haven't taught now Sunday school or worked. I was on the church board for 25 years. I have a nice silver dish that was given to me. And I've acted as superintendent over here and as teacher in the Bible class and the high school class. And in Moscow, it was college kids and young married couples and high school youngsters. I never did teach little tiny children.
What is it that you would tell your class? You started to say you would tell your classes.
Oh, I would tell them of my experience of my baptism and tell them to always try to have that same experience, that just to feel that you're going down into the water, it represents to the world a burial, and we're buried with Christ, and we will be raised with Him, and it's a wonderful experience.
Was this what denomination was the
Church of God? Not that cult that's around. There's a cult now. There's two, three cults that call themselves Church of God, but they're not. There's one in Lewiston, I know, and
they're the ones that had the camp meeting by Colfax. The ones that you went.
Yeah,
to
it was the Church
meeting.
Of God. Their headquarters is Anderson, Indiana. They have one of the biggest printing houses of their literature they put out in America. It's the Warner Press Company, and they're not like these cults. I've seen these cults, several of them, and they call themselves Church of God, but they're not.
Well, what's unique about the Church of God that makes it the church that you find the most?
They're not a sect. You can't join the Church of God if you are a Christian. Even if you belong over here, you're in the Church of God. But we don't, the Christian church knows that way too. You can't join the Christian church. We're not a sect. We just don't join. I've never had my name on a church book in my life, and I never will. When you become a Christian, you're born. Jesus said you must be born again. You know, that's what he said to Nicodemus. Ye must be born again. And when you are, and really and truly converted, you're born into the Church of God, and you're a member. Whether you realize it or not, you're a member of the Church of God. And you don't need that extra name. You don't need Baptist. You don't need Methodist. Of course, now there are Christians in all of those churches. Even in the Catholic Church, there's Christian people. I don't say that there's not, because there is. And our motto has always been, we extend the hand of fellowship to every blood-washed one. And that includes every Christian. No matter what church they're in, they're a child of God. They belong to the Church of God.
What does blood washed mean? To the blood washed means a born again?
Yes, to be born again. Blood. I've been washed in the blood. How is that? How does that go? I've been born of the Spirit. Born of the Spirit and washed in the blood.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've kept you now. Well, you must get...